Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. You don't have to live out west to love the wilderness. Even the most jaded city dwellers carry a fantasy of clear blue skies and crisp mountain air somewhere in their soul. And while the vast majority of wild areas are in the west, smaller sections can be found from Florida's Apalachicola National Forest to New Hampshire's White Mountains. On Monday, a federal judge overturned the Clinton administration's roadless rule, which banned road building in a third of our national forests, charging that it was a wilderness land grab. And last night, Congress debated another law that would have discouraged road building on all of the nation's public lands. But the Republican-controlled Congress took the muscle out of that bill before passing it, leaving open the possibility of development all over the West. There's gold in them thar hills, oil mostly, but gas too, and timber. And the Bush administration's plan includes having access to all of it. Connection listeners, whose interests should come first here? The people whose livelihoods depend on those lands, and the desires of SUV owners who want to turn their wheels off-road at any time, or the desire of environmentalists and others who want to protect the wilderness for tomorrow? How has wilderness shaped the American character? And why is wilderness important to you? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And in a moment, we're going to be hearing more about those amendments and congressional action with Congressman Mark Udall. And we're also going to be speaking to a rancher who lives in Garfield County in South Central Utah. But I want to begin by welcoming Rick Bass, who is the author of several books, both nonfiction and novels, about the wilderness. Rick lives in a remote corner of Montana called Yak Valley. Hello, Rick.
Good morning, Gail.
Well, thanks so much for being with us. And you had to do some considerable driving to get to a place where you could talk to us. So I want to thank you for making that extra effort.
Sure.
Start by helping us understand the big picture here. I really don't want to go into the congressional action. We'll do that with the congressman. You're off the hook there. But give us the broadest possible sense of what the issue is here. What's at stake?
I'm pausing because so many things are at stake. I could talk for the whole program about different things that are at stake, but I guess from the broadest perspective, it's the last of the last just crumbs of wildness that hasn't been protected in this country. And it's a philosophical argument. It's not a resource argument the way the administration is trying to paint it. These are the last few remote places that. The reason they're still remote is because it's real expensive or perhaps even impossible to get into these areas, for whether it's for oil or gas or timber. It's a philosophical argument, which makes it all the more intense.
And basically you're saying once they're gone, they're gone.
Exactly. It's going to cost a lot of money to eradicate them, to liquidate this last unprotected wilderness. And then, as you say, once it's gone, it's not wilderness.
I want to hear some more about your personal battle to keep the Yak Valley, where you live, roadless. But I'm also intrigued by how the wilderness came to be so important to you. You're a city boy. You grew up in a subdivision in Houston.
Exactly. And I figured out real quick, I think that's why I love the wilderness so much. I grew up in Houston, which, on a weekend, I might get up into the hill country around Crawford and go hunting or something. But that was just a taste of the outdoors. I didn't really find out what the American wilderness was like until I got out to Montana and Utah. And it's a qualitative difference. You can't really measure. I mean, you can measure it in terms of species diversity and top tier carnivores and acreage and forest types and so forth. But it's a qualitative feeling. You step into wild country and you just relax. Even if you didn't realize you were tense before, everything in you relaxes.
Hmm. And as I understand it, you went on a journey, really, to find that area and wound up in the Yak Valley. What was it about that area in particular that spoke to you, that enabled you to, I guess, stop the car and say, okay, I'm here?
It's a question I still ask myself almost 20 years later. It's like asking, why do you fall in love with a certain person? It's not any one thing. But when it happens, it happens. What aimed me toward the Yak was it was a big blank green spot on the map, and there weren't many of those left, even in Montana. And the whole valley is not roadless. It's about 1 million acres, and 97% of it is national forest. There's just little ribbons of private land along the rivers. But there's, of that 1 million acres, there's only about 180,000 acres left that don't have roads through it. So even a wild place like the Yaak up on the Canadian border is 80% roaded and developed from past timber harvest. So again, we're talking about high elevation crumbs, just the very last pieces that industry hasn't gotten to yet as while they've been liquidating the public holdings. And then the industry leaves for the southeastern U.S. where trees grow faster, where they import their timber from New Zealand where it grows even faster. It's a corporate liquidation. It's heartbreaking when you fall in love with a place that you own as a public citizen that you own.
And when you look at that place now, Rick, is it still the green spot that it once was, or has a lot of it been clear cut?
A lot of it has been clear cut. A lot of it has been roaded. It is still the place I fell in love with. It still has all of the species that were there since the last ice age, and there are very few places that can be said in the lower 48 to very few valleys that can make that claim. And that's one of the ways that I define wildness and wilderness is the life that's in it, not just the glacial, rock and ice, beautiful lake country that was protected early in the wilderness movement, but a biological wilderness that is just so rich and fecund. The Yaak is a very low elevation, kind of rainforest place, and that's rare in the wilderness system. I should point out there's not 1 acre in the Yaak that's protected as wilderness, which is crazy for it to be this one of the wildest places in the lower 48, not 1 acre.
Well, Rick, stay with us for a minute. I want to bring into the conversation Del LaFever, who is a rancher from Garfield County in south central Utah, also one of the most beautiful places on earth. Welcome, Del.
Hello. How are you?
Very well, thanks. I appreciate you joining us. Tell us a little bit about why this is an issue for you, because for you it's not just the sort of aesthetic appreciation of the land, it's also this is how you make your living.
Right. I'm a rancher. I run on public lands, and these roads is crucial to me coming and going. And not only me, it's crucial to the tourist. And what we're trying to do basically is shut down any road maintenance in Garfield County and King County.
What do you mean by shut down road maintenance?
Okay, that you cannot grade a road in this RS-2775 without going to BLM first.
Okay, and listeners, I promise we're going to explain what the 2477 fight is all about in just a moment. But for the moment, let's let you continue, Dale.
Okay, and you can't get outside the disturbed area. And we have millions of acres that's already wilderness. I don't care whether they're designated or not designated. They're wilderness. And I guess this is the thing that's really bothering me. And right now, we have a huge fire on the Henry Mountains. And the reason we have that fire is we've cut back on grazing and thinning and whatever, and that fire was started by a motorbike. And I know your environmental groups like to say that's natural, but man starting a fire is not natural by a motorized vehicle. So we're going to burn the Henry Mountains. They're very steep. You can't even find a place to put a sleeping bag down. It's up or down. And them mountains would be forever coming back. And if they would have been taken care of like a garden, we wouldn't have that today. And that's my fear. We're going to burn it now. We've shut down grazing, we've shut down timber, and we're shutting down the roads. They couldn't even get to the Henry Mountain roads because they've been shut down to fight the fire.
Well, for you, Del, as I understand it, in order for you to get to where your cattle are grazing, you're having to ride over some fairly rough territory.
Oh, it's mean. I have to go 30 miles up a miserable little canyon to get to my allotment, which people... It's not only me. People would run that road. Tourists would go up and down that road if there's access. But the roads, even with Kane and Garfield owning if they owned them, it's still hard to maintain these roads. You get a flash flood, they wash out. They are weeks before they can get there. And I have a real problem with closing these down because these areas is big. I mean, we're talking about big areas. The road just a line through the sand.
So you not only want roads, you would like roads that are well-maintained so that you're not having to spend a fortune on your trucks going over.
Right. I probably have spent $10,000 just this year on tires and trailer and truck maintenance bouncing over these roads. And I'm not the only cowboy. There's a lot of us. And they're getting fewer, but there's a lot of people use these roads. And the maintenance on our vehicles is just unreal.
Dale, do you have any issue in terms of, I know you have a number of children, 14 adopted children, is that right?
14 adopted children.
Do you have any worries about whether this land is still going to be there in good shape for your grandchildren?
Right now, I could not, with the regulations on me as a rancher, not only, and it's not all government, with the economics, I could give this ranch to any one of these kids, and they'd go broke within 2 years.
How's that?
Because of the land, okay, since the monument in Garfield County, land has went from 1,000 an acre that we're talking about, farmland, to 14,000 an acre. So how does a rancher survive? What he does, he subdivides his property and goes somewhere else and ranch.
So for you, it's not an issue of wilderness versus ranching. It's having a life that doesn't include subdivisions next door.
That's right. That is exactly right. You can't ranch with subdivisions and lots of people running around. You can't do it.
Well, Dale, let me ask Rick Bass. Rick, what would you say to Dale?
Well, Dale's down in quite different country, but we hear a lot of the same arguments. We see a lot of fire up in Montana, and most of it is around, as Dale mentioned, with the motorbike going up and down the road, human-caused, or adjacent to areas that have been logged and have dried out and lost their old forest characteristics that maintain more moisture. You get a lot of wind throw and insect damage surrounding clear cuts, and that makes the forest more vulnerable to fire. Not that fire is necessarily a bad thing. It can be. There's all different levels of fire. It's part of the natural ecosystem long before man came, and people have always been burning the landscape to try and increase the productivity. Him talking about the roads being so rough, the roads up in Montana are rough, too. I think the Forest Service has got like $8 or $9 billion backlog in debt, public taxpayer responsibility to repair those roads for the timber and ranching and tourist industries. And I'm not sure that it's worth the fight to go in and repair these roads that have gone back into remote country that shouldn't have been put there in the first place, that are degrading the water quality, the streams, and the native ecosystems.
Rick, let me throw the question. Hold on one sec. I want to throw the question quickly back to Dale. So, Dale, what you're saying is you want access for everybody to this land, not just for you.
Right. I want access for everybody. See, his is a different deal than mine. He's dealing with the Forest Service, and there's no logging on this I'm talking about. A lot of it has been wilderness study area. None of it's been designated yet. But my road from Escalante goes to Pate. They go somewhere. My road in the Circle Cliffs goes to Bullfrog. I mean, our roads go to a destiny, not just a road going out in the forest somewhere and quitting.
All right, Dale, we'll leave it there for now. Thank you so much for joining us. Connection listeners, we're talking this hour about wilderness, and specifically about how wilderness has shaped the American character, how some of these areas may be in danger, and why wilderness is important to you. Is it? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and this is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris, and this is The Connection from NPR. We're talking this hour about the hold that the American wilderness has on our imagination and some of the issues and how they differ from your point of view. If you are a rancher, you look at it one way, obviously. If you are an author, as is Rick Bass, you have a different perception of it. Rick Bass is the author of several books about the wilderness and lives in a remote corner of Montana called Yaak Valley. Rick, you heard Dale Lefevre make the argument a moment ago that this is public land. It ought to be public use. What's the problem with that?
There is no problem with it if the public use is compatible with sustaining the resource. There's the Multiple Use Act passed by Congress calls for ranching, logging, mining interest on the public lands, and that in itself is debatable, but wilderness is a public use. And again, when we're talking about wilderness in the United States, only 2% of the landmass is protected. We're talking about crumbs, and the current administration is trying to push into the very last 2%. That's where I have the problem.
Hmm.
It's the totalitarianism of the argument, the lack of acknowledgement that there are some places that are wild and that should be kept wild. And that's always been part of the American spirit and American character. And now in these last 3 years, it's under assault that makes the Reagan years look like the good old days.
I wonder if you could help our listeners get an idea of just how close to wilderness you are. Perhaps you'd read a short passage for us from the Book of Yak, one of your works. But tell us what it's about, first of all. What were you doing there?
Sure. In this book I wrote, the Book of Yak, I was trying to examine all the different perspectives and arguments why we need wilderness in a place like the Yak, which, again, doesn't have a single acre, the wildest place I've ever been in this country, and not one acre of that, all that public land is designated. My argument is not that all of the Yak should be designated wilderness, just that last 180,000 acres out of the million, the last part that we haven't put roads into. So this book is about all the different reasons, economic, ecologic, watershed, air quality, forest diversity, all of the different reasons I could think of, different reason for each chapter. And I'll read this section. I was out hunting in the autumn, and I'd been seeing grizzlies. It's a really rare thing. We've only got between 1 and 2 dozen grizzlies left in the Yak. It's the most endangered population of grizzlies in the lower 48, and more than any other species, grizzlies need big, wild country. They're just such an uncompromising and specialized animal that they need big, wild country. And I'd had this great week where I was seeing a grizzly almost every day. I've never had a week like that before or since. The sun was orange over Buckhorn Ridge. I was hiking along a deer trail, noting an old elk sign. The trail followed a shelf along the mountain, a southern exposure, with aspen above and below me. I was going to cross it and then go into some big cedars and follow those woods up the mountain just a little farther before turning back and heading home. It was the time of day, late in the afternoon, when you are most likely to see all sorts of animals, though because of the strong wind, I did not think I would see any. Sometimes the wind was in my face, but other times it quartered from upslope, from the north. The aspen leaves were beautiful, shading to bright yellow, and they rattled in that strong wind. I came around a bend in the trail, the whole valley below me, and saw a golden bear walking slowly toward me, not 40 yards away. Too close. Too damn close. She was smallish, about twice my size, and her thick forelegs were chocolate brown, while all the rest of her fur was sunstruck blonde. The wide face, the round ears, the hump over her shoulder, another grizzly, but coming toward me, unlike yesterday's, and averting her gaze, not making eye contact. Swinging her head and shoulders left and right of me, looking everywhere but at me. I was dumb enough to believe for a second that she did not know I was there. The wind ruffled her fur, blowing from behind me now like a traitor, and in that cold instant I knew she knew. One yearling cub appeared behind her, 10 or 15 yards back, looking exceedingly nervous, and then directly behind that one, its twin, also looking troubled, not playing as cubs do, but looking hesitant, looking uncertain. We were all too close. The mother stopped about 30 yards away, the villainous wind gusting at my back, and she circled a quarter turn and pretended to gaze out at the valley below. She was so beautiful in the disappearing sunlight that seemed to paint her that gold color. Her cubs came anxiously up the trail behind her, almost dancing in their nervousness, seeming to want to rise to their hind feet and turn away and go back in the other direction, but obliged to follow. And I understood now that she too was nervous, that she was trying to move me out of her territory. Instinctively, I circled a quarter turn to the south and looked out at the valley, too. I dropped my head to show her I was not a threat. I felt fear, but even stronger, apology, even dismay. I felt incredible respect for her, too, and a surge of gratitude. We both studied the valley for a moment. I was waiting to see if she would charge. A thing passed between us, as if we were wired directly together for a moment, the knowledge and understanding by both of us that she had every right, more than every right, to charge me, and whether in bluff or attack, no matter, she was almost mandated to charge. and yet she chose not to.
Well, Rick, you know, I don't know that I would ever personally want to encounter a bear, but I'm glad you did because you write about it so beautifully. Help us make the connection between imagination and wilderness. Is there something about wilderness that really connects us to a deeper part of ourselves?
There sure is for me, and I think about it a lot. And it's like talking about magic. You kind of don't want to explain it away, but and even when you talk about it, you're talking usually about the abstracts rather than the feel of cedar bark on your hand or the sight of a grizzly. But what I feel when I'm in really wild nature is how incredibly complex and ordered and precise and interconnected that system is. And when I'm often in the world of man, it feels very fragmented and still kind of confused and searching, a real disordered system at times. And I think that's what imagination, a lot of time, to my way of thinking, is trying to weave things together and put things back together. And so I think that's what I sense when I go in the wilderness. Wow, here's a place where everything is still intact, not yet torn apart, not yet fragmented. Everything relies upon everything else and is connected to other things in ways that we don't yet know and may never know. And I feel that intuitively, and I think that spurs the imagination. If you sense or feel that kind of grace and logic is going on in one place, then you go back to your disordered system or your stressed system, and you think, okay, here's how it can be put back together. Or you think, okay, it can be put back together. I can imagine, quite frankly, a happy ending.
Mm. Do you see this as a peculiarly American trait? Because I think it's something that we can all relate to on some level, no matter where we live.
It seems to be. I'm struck by European and other visitors who come to the West, and they just walk around with their mouths open, feeling that spirit of wildness that they don't have in their country. Certainly, there's some huge, vast, wild places and some really wild native cultures still left in scraps and corners around the world. But for a country of our population to still have even a ghost of that ethos and respect for wilderness, that symbiotic relationship, it is rare in the so-called developed or civilized world, and it's wonderful for it.
And you think about so much of our history is bound up in, you know, the great frontier, pushing west, going into places that hadn't been explored before.
Exactly. The position of the individual against the magnificent of the landscape, of a wild landscape, is a very humbling and yet strengthening perception and realization. It brings out the best in people, or it can.
Well, Rick, we have some listeners who want to get in on the conversation as well. First, we're going to Boston, Massachusetts, and hear from Ted. Hello, Ted.
Hey, Gail. How are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Nice to have you on The Connection. Just wanted to make a point about reaching back to what your guest just said, that it's not just about saving some obscure animals, and I think that's often been the problem with the whole environmental movement. Wilderness areas are so important to help clean the air we breathe, the water we drink, slow global warming, prevent flooding, and we don't really often necessarily make the connection between our own personal future and our own health with protecting the natural areas, and I think they're intricately linked.
So, Ted, do you think if those links were a little more clear to everyone, this might be a bit easier argument?
I think it would be a whole different world, you know, if people understood the personal advantages or gains or benefits for them and their children and their, you know, grandchildren and beyond. It's not just about, you know, it wouldn't just be about some furry little woodchuck or something, but about ourselves.
Hmm. And Rick, I've read where you get so angry when you see what's done on Capitol Hill on some of these issues. You're just absolutely about ready to bite nails.
Well, it's true, and I mean I'm being careful not to sound disrespectful to Ted, who sounds like he's in the choir, and I agree with everything he's saying. But I might differ if I'm hearing what y'all are saying. I think folks do recognize the at some level, whether with the intimacy of specific knowledge or just that what Wallace Stegner called the wilderness idea, that these places are important to us and they are publicly held for reasons beyond the charismatic megaphone of grizzlies and stuff. And it's Capitol Hill, as you point out, that that betrays that trust. Typically, 80 to 90% of the American public will weigh in saying, protect these last corners, these last crumbs of roadless areas. But somehow that 80 to 90% wish is converted to turned upside down in bills such as the one last night. And that's the corporate influence. So yeah, I mean, I agree with you, Ted, for sure. The more education that can be done to the American public about this treasury, this heritage, this legacy is wonderful. But I also think, you know, that to some extent we get it. I mean, the wilderness areas contain 80% or filter 80% of the nation's fresh water supply. I mean, 80% of our water in a drought decade. We could spend 100 years putting down the scientific or even any kind of facts. I think the change is going to have come on Capitol Hill, and so far in this administration, it's going the other way, despite the will of the people.
Ted, do you get out on the weekends and go hiking or spend time out in the wilderness?
I do. I get up to Maine quite a bit, and I love it. It really makes me. It's something about going to the wilderness that is, I think, unattainable anywhere else, and that's why people, you know, are flooding into the wilderness. And I think it's good to keep some areas where they're not, you know, where we're not overrunning them. I think that everyone. It would be great if everyone understood the facts and the magic that writers and your guest understand and have known about for years. But I think there's still quite a big gap there when it comes down to, you know, to brass tacks, what people are willing to stand up for, and therefore what the what the politicians will stand up for. I think if they felt that there was an incredible surge against a decision like this, they wouldn't dare try and do it. So it's really about that they're not hearing it. You know, people are for the environment until there are other things
okay.
know, that come up. And
so, Ted, let me push you a little bit on this.
Yeah.
Are you writing your letter? Are you speaking up and weighing in politically?
Absolutely, yeah. I write letters. I get a lot of email notices and send off letters through NRDC and
great.
Environmental League of Massachusetts, and there's all sorts of good organizations out there that are doing good things. But we are, I think we're still in the minority in terms of people who will take action and not just feel that this is important, but you know, get caught up in their own personal lives,
okay.
their education, other issues.
Okay, Ted. Well, thank you so much for the call. We appreciate it. Let's go to Durham, North Carolina next and hear from Steve. Hello, Steve. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. I really had a question for Mr. Bass just about the tension that we talked about a little bit earlier. One of the things we celebrated was the idea that Americans have pushed into the frontier to explore new worlds, and so in some sense we want to keep that for people to explore, and yet it seems to me inherent within that passion is the tension that we end up facing the very frontier that we've pushed into. And how do we change a culture that wants to push forward into new areas and basically control it or take over it without at the same time getting rid of that passion for the wilderness, that passion for the frontier?
What about that, Rick? Is that even possible?
I believe it is, and I'm not sure that I'm understanding the question. Could you say it again? I don't want to go off on the wrong track.
Sure. One of the things, I guess, earlier you were celebrating here on the show was the tradition in America to push out into the frontier, into the wilderness. That's part of the American spirit. And I guess I was just noting that within that, though, obviously, is once we push into that frontier, we tend then to colonize that frontier. And how do we keep the passion for moving into the wilderness, pushing into new unexplored places without maintaining the colonizing component of that, which I think is also part and parcel of that American spirit?
Well, I think that's why the Wilderness Act was passed in 1964 with a 371-1 vote in the House. And it's defined wilderness, national land in the National Wilderness Preservation System is defined as land where man is but a visitor, and his signs are unrecognizable. And we're not talking about pushing in with colonization or bulldozers. We're talking about going in on foot or horseback and leaving very little, if any, trace. Big big secure areas where again, in that eloquent language of the Act, we are but a visitor.
Steve, thank you so much for the call. And Rick, what about the larger point that Steve's raising here, that, you know, that it's not just about specific pieces of legislation, it's about larger cultural attitudes. You know, when do we know when it's time to stop?
You know, this is kind of abstract, but I recognize that spirit of drive in our culture. And like Ted mentioned earlier about the lack of intensity on the public that's letting the administration get away with this kind of stuff. If we could harness that drive to push forward, if we could convert it to a drive to protect the last precious places that, you know, the last few pages of our book of wildness in this country, we can use that same spirit to a positive end. It doesn't necessarily have to be a negative thing. So it comes back to Ted's comment, I think, about intensity. We have, as a culture, we've shown in the past we're capable of responding intensely to the defense of our heritage and land, and I sure hope it comes quick.
And actually, we've seen one example of, what was it, 160,000 letters about letting wolves roam through Yellowstone, and now they are.
That's a great point, and it kind of jumps to the, or it makes me think of the roadless rule that to protect these last roadless lands that passed during 3 years of the Clinton administration. We had 2.2 million people comment in 90% of them in favor, over 90% in favor of protecting these last crumbs of roadless lands in the country. The far and away the most comments ever solicited or garnered on a conservation measure, you know, by a factor of six or more for the wolf issue. And yet, again, the Bush administration is turning it upside down. It's crazy.
Connection listeners, we're talking this hour about the importance of the American wilderness and inviting you to join the conversation on the topic of what it means to you. Is it important? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Gail Harris, and this is The Connection from NPR. We're talking this hour about the American wilderness and its hold on our imagination, and even more importantly, about how it's being used. Connection listeners, should it be available to be used by the public any way they choose or not? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And now joining us on the line is Congressman Mark Udall, Democrat of Colorado. He's with us from the floor of the House, and he filed an amendment that would keep the federal government from abandoning its legal title to roads in places that are now or someday might be designated as wilderness areas. Welcome, Congressman.
Gail, thank you for having me on. Good morning to you.
Well, we appreciate your joining us, and particularly knowing that you were there last night at midnight for this vote. You must be pretty tired.
I'm tired. I'm tired, but that's the way the House seems to operate.
So help us understand. We've heard from Rick Bass, who, as you know, is a wonderful writer about wilderness issues, and from a rancher who relies on these lands for his livelihood. From your perspective, what's at stake here?
There's a lot at stake. I'm a native Rocky Mountain Westerner, and there's something about the West that's special. I've traveled all over the world climbing on many of the world's highest mountains, and whenever I return home, I think I've come back to heaven, frankly. And the open spaces we have, the sense that those open spaces give us of human freedom and the need for freedom, I think is at some risk if we don't protect the open spaces and ensure that our children and their children can have the same kinds of experiences that we've had. This administration in particular seems to not get it. I don't think that everybody in the administration has nefarious purposes or somehow thinks their policies are going to result in the lessening of our wilderness opportunities, but frankly, many of their policies will have that very result. So the people here who are battling at this level to stop the administration, to get them to take another look, and at the same time hope that people on the ground will make the case as well.
Well, speaking of that, Congressman, we're certainly hearing this hour from listeners who are very concerned about this issue. Obviously, Rick Bass has been fighting this fight for a long time. Why is that not being heard, or doesn't seem to be being heard quite as clearly on Capitol Hill where you are?
It's a mystery to me. On some days, on other days, I see the hands of economic interests having the upper hand, frankly. There's also an ongoing battle in the West between what I call the Old West and the New West. And I do believe there are people who inhabit the Old West who understand the potential that the New West presents. But there are others, I think, that want to hold on to the past and want, as I think Charles Wilkinson, the writer and the law professor of the University of Colorado, describes, the lords of yesteryear, those interests that focus on the commodities the West can provide, not understanding anymore that probably the greatest product the West has from an economic point of view is its clean air and open vistas and vast lands, and that's how we ought to be building our future economy, understanding that there are still some legitimate uses that we ought to promote, ranching among them. I think there's still a real place for the ranching community, and the ranching community should thrive and have those opportunities.
Well, Congressman,
that's the battle that's underway, the old and new West, and as we're going to metamorphose into the new West, and it's a question of what that new West will look like.
Congressman, we thank you so much for joining us.
I'm very glad to have been on with you. Thank you.
Congressman Mark Udall joined us from the floor of the House. He is Democrat from Colorado. Rick Bass, is there common ground here?
There's so much, and I'm laughing, not disrespectfully, listening to the dialogue. It's emblematic of an activist life in the West these days. You would think, okay, you have this goal. You want to protect these last crumbs, this wilderness. So you spend 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 10 years a decade working toward that. But it's not that simple, because there is so much common ground. We are trying to preserve, in our neck of the woods, a logging culture. We're working with independent mill owners, of which there are increasingly few, due to global competition and cheaper lumber, cheaper timber coming from elsewhere. We're still working with them, quite sharing in their homework, trying to find a way to keep that culture intact where they can keep working on, not just on in their culture, but in their culture on public lands. There are plenty of places, in my view, on the National Forest that not only can tolerate logging, but would benefit from logging in the so-called urban wildland interface, where the very small trees can be thinned, but the trouble is the very small trees usually cost money. So how can you develop an infrastructure that will utilize that wood and keep that culture intact, that ability to treat that product, that material, but stay the heck out of the backcountry? So we're having some luck with the independent mill owners, and they're agreeing, yes, we couldn't afford to go into those roadless areas anyway. It speaks to, it's an economic transition, but it's also the end of the frontier, the days of liquidating. The big trees are gone. Either you adapt and learn how to make a living thinning the very small trees next to villages and towns, or you're going to, you know, you didn't adapt the way that so many other industries have had to retool.
Go ahead. Well, we've got a listener from Buffalo, New York we want to check in with. Robin's on the line. Hello, Robin. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much. I'm disabled, and though I can no longer see the wilderness, I just need to know that it's there. Only 1.5 or 2% of the country is still wilderness, and if we can't save that, we can't save ourselves. I mean, this is not as much a philosophical issue as it is an economic and survival issue. You know, and I am sorry that a few thousand ranchers in the whole country are going to be affected. When I was younger, I was a forester, so I was on both sides. The Adirondack wilderness is like almost 4 million acres, and that was created in the 1880s. And the same arguments we're hearing today were presented then, and it's been such a huge boon to New York State to have that wilderness, and it protected the watershed for about 14 million people.
So you see room for compromise here, Robin?
No, I think what's wilderness really needs to be locked up and saved. We don't have the wisdom on how to manage wilderness. When I was a forester, I thought we did, but as humans, we don't. If we can't save that, we can't save ourselves. That's my bottom line.
Well, thank you for the call, Robin. We appreciate hearing from you. Rick, what about that? I'm thinking about some of your writing when you talked about roaming the wilderness as a young man and being worried about its future then. And, of course, now you're a little older and you're a father. It must feel even more urgent for you.
Absolutely. I want to be clear. When I talk about common ground, I'm not talking about working, logging in the wilderness. The other areas outside of that last 2%, there is a real distinct line for me also. When the speaker was talking about the need to just know that those wild places are out there, I was reminded of the Aldo Leopold quote, that one of the early foresters and a Forest Service employee, a champion of wilderness, who helped pass the first wilderness in this country. He said, I'm glad I shall never be young without wild country to be young in. But wilderness is not just a young man's or a young woman's fabric or canvas or landscape. As you reach middle age and start realizing your physical limitations, it does sweeten and give greater complexity to the landscape. And then when you're old, I suppose that it's even richer for having known it and having felt those physical and all the other senses so deeply and specifically and remembering them. Maybe not able to get as far into the woods, but looking at them and knowing that you did and that other people did and that future generations will, and then you can talk to young people about, oh yeah, what Lost Horse Mountain's like or what the backside of Grizzly Peak is like. It becomes a kind of social currency, a biological currency, a shared story that transcends age.
We want to go to Watertown now and hear more on this point from Bill. Hello, Bill.
Yes, how are you this morning?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
Well, I've been an environmentalist all my life, and I would like to make a comment about the image of the environmental movement, that there's so much emphasis today on strength and power and winning that in order to combat something like the Bush administration, I think we as environmentalists should capture Teddy Roosevelt and that image of the strength of the environmental movement, rather than the hand-wringing, the so-called tree-huggers, and so on and so forth, a position of weakness. I also think that we lose young people. When I was young, the Boy Scout movement was very strong. There was a lot of time in the woods. And also, every Sunday, there was a marked trail in the comics. And that seems to be gone now. And all that is a great way to educate the young people about the environment.
All right. We appreciate the comment, Bill.
Thank you.
What about that, Rick? Is this, and yet at the same time, I would imagine that the Outward Bound programs and some of these wilderness programs are doing very well. No?
No, they are increasingly. I mean, every aspect of society is learning or relearning to look to these last little crumbs of wilderness for what they have to offer in terms of rehabilitating and healing or instructing, teaching at every level. College courses in interdisciplinary sciences are using wilderness as on-site teaching facilities. Youth camps are going into wild places to for the purity of that experience. And I guess about the speaker's other comment about maybe presenting a burlier image of the environmentalist. It's a good point that everybody has a place at the table. I'm kind of a burly guy, and I really delight in talking about airy fairy things like ferns and hugging trees, just to watch the gruff foresters in the discussions squirm and vice versa. They know I'm that way, and so they like talking about watching the sap come out of a nice big green pickle, which is what they call the really big trees, the few that are left. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, it's also become a really polarizing issue where you are, though, has it not? I mean, it sounds as if it's not the kind of thing you really want to be arguing about in a bar with a stranger.
It has been so polarizing for so long that environmentalists in my little valley have just put our ears back and said, this is who we are. We're not going to be shunned any longer. We have a place at the table. These are our lands. And there's been this wonderful core of really courageous individuals up there who have stepped up and said that. And back to the other comment, they range from road builders to loggers to hunters, hunting guides, fishing guides, artists, painters, poets, nurses, doctors, high school principals, road builders, just this incredible, everybody has a place at the table, and they're all finding the courage in this polarized community to say, look, this is where I draw my line, this is where I stand my ground in the wilderness. I'm willing to have the courage to work with you in this area of common ground against people who've been hating us for as long as we can remember, just because of how we feel about wild country. And slowly we are breaking down those barriers in the community to some extent, but again, back to Capitol Hill.
Hmm. Do you feel that in those conversations that you are able to make that link for people between imagination and the wilderness, and the fact that this is not just a physical thing we're talking about? It's also what's happening with the pictures in your head and the connection that people feel on some very deep level to the land.
I have not been able to make that connection, and maybe the reason is that the wilderness is something, in some respects, it's the same to all of us, especially those of us who see it every day, but it's also different to everybody. It's slightly different, and so it's that they understand that's what it means to me, and they respect that, but I also need to understand that maybe imagination is not, you know, high on their flip chart. They may just like the shape of the ridge against the sky at dusk, so it's, I present my relationship with the landscape as being, it nurtures my imagination, but that's just me, the poet. That everybody else has their different needs and relationship with the landscape. But that's what makes it so rich. That's what makes it so wonderful. That's what makes it so vital.
And thank goodness for you and other poets, because you help the rest of us see it too. Thank you so much, Rick Bass. We appreciate your being with us.
Thank you.
Rick Bass is the author of several books about the wilderness, including The Book of Yak. And by the way, Rick wins the award for the Connection guest who drove the farthest to get to a studio so he could be with us. He drove 5 hours in the dead of night so that he could be with us today, and we thank him very much. We heard earlier from Congressman Mark Udall of Colorado and rancher Del Fever, who lives in Garfield County, Utah. And Connection listeners, if you'd like to continue the conversation online, you can do so by visiting the forum section of our website, theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Kelly Jones, Arit Karitsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Our interns are Kate Zernowski and Alex Began. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection.